You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Leah Bulger, the president of Veterans for Peace. Leah, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Leah, I had read something in the news just last week about you going to court for interrupting a subcommittee in Congress, I think it was. Before we get into that, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background of who you are?
I joined the Navy in 1980 in a nutshell because I needed a job and I didn't get into the grad school I wanted. And I joined the Navy and I stuck it out for 20 years because it was interesting work and I was moving around the world a lot and I was given a lot of responsibility right off the bat and it was interesting. So I didn't think a whole lot about any kind of moral implications about being a part of the military at that time, but it was a job and I did it for 20 years and then I got out and didn't really get very involved in politics or activism until about 2005. I saw an exhibit of the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, the Quaker group, had an exhibit called Eyes Wide Open. I'm sure many of your followers have seen this exhibit, but the main part of it is rows of boots, American military boots, with the names of the people who've been killed in combat attached to the boots. They're lined up very carefully in rows as if they were tombstones, and it's very, very powerful. But this exhibit also pointed out the deaths of Iraqis, and they had small shoes to represent children. And seeing this exhibit, I had a very, very powerful reaction to it. That's what really prompted me to get involved and really become an activist for peace. So the more I've been involved in activism, the more I've realized that it's not so simple to just call for an end to war, that our government is so entrenched that the political, military, media, corporate machine is so locked in together and such a formidable force that it's very, very difficult to make any headway, and that this powerful machine has really corrupted our democracy. I'm finding out that the American people are not being represented, the will of the people is not being heard, and that's essentially why I interrupted this committee, to speak on behalf of the American people.
I usually use the word monolithic to describe what you were talking about. It seems like it is a monolithic organism that we're up against here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that? Is monolithic too stark of a term?
Yeah, no, I agree. The mono part, one, it's all together. I kind of liken it to this big knot of yarn or string or something. It's very difficult to figure out where to start pulling the string to get it to unravel because it's so tightly wound and dependent on each other to create this knot. It's a very, very difficult problem.
Yeah. I want to go back to 1980 because I went into the Navy in 1980, actually in March of 1980.
Me too.
Don't say March 30th.
I think it was 19th, but I'm not sure. I don't remember.
You beat me. What did you do in the Navy?
I joined the military, as I mentioned, because I didn't get into the grad school I wanted. So I had my bachelor's degree. So I went to Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island, and I was given a commission. At the time, the opportunities for women or the job choices for women were very limited, and we couldn't serve on any ships that were considered combatant ships or aircraft, very, very limited. Most of us were lumped into this general unrestricted line category. So I was a line officer. I wasn't a restricted, like, supply corps or medical corps or something like that. I was a line officer, but I wasn't warfare qualified. My first assignment was in Keflavik, Iceland, and I worked in an anti-submarine warfare program called SOSUS, which stands for Sound Surveillance System. It's a passive sonar that sits on the bottom of the ocean and just receives signals and tracks submarines. And anything in the ocean emits whales or mechanical things emit frequencies that are then translated into signals, and you can discern these different signals to determine what the source of the sound is. So it was very interesting. This was 1980 at the height of the Cold War, and there were lots of Soviet submarines going through the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap, and I had about 30 people working for me, and I'd never been a supervisor before, so I was given a lot of responsibility, and it was interesting, exciting work, and I was living in a foreign country, which was also very exciting to me. I grew up in Missouri, and one of the reasons why I joined the Navy was because I had worked for a summer at Whiteman Air Force Base, and I thought, oh man, you know, if I joined the Air Force or the Army, I could end up right back here again in
right.
the middle of, of nowhere. So it was exciting to me. And I think that's why a lot of people join the military. They need a job or they want the money for education. And it's exciting. It's a way to get out of their little town they grew up in or away from home. That's why we join.
Right. Mostly. And to serve your country, which was a big part of why I joined, and I'm sure that was a big part of why you joined.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that it was why I joined the military. In fact, it may be for a lot of people that's why they joined. But frankly, I didn't think about it really as a service to the country. And especially in retrospect, when you look at how the military is used, when people join the military, very little of what they're doing is defending this country. And our military has not been used as a defensive force since World War II.
Right.
Military folks are exploited. You will not see people who have full scholarships or their parents are very rich and can send them to whatever college they like. You won't see very many of those people joining the military. And there's a reason for that. So when people join, I think they are exploited. And I wouldn't go so far as to call them victims necessarily, but they are definitely tools and being used by the government. So I don't like to use that service to the country. In fact, when people thank me for my service, that really bothers me. I think that's very patronizing. The person who says that has no idea what I did when I was on active duty. And in fact, I didn't do anything that I'm not proud of, but I didn't do anything exceptional. I was a good officer and I got good reports and awards and everything, but it wasn't anything particularly extraordinary. I tell people I'm a veteran because I want them to understand that when I say the war is futile and war is an abomination, or when my organization, more exactly, when Veterans for Peace says war is futile and war should be obsolete, that's why we mention we're veterans, not because we want to be thanked for our service. And there are many, many veterans who are ashamed and really horrified by what they did when they were in the military, that they can't get away from things that were criminal, and they were forced to participate in things that violated their moral conscience that are really, really painful to them now. You say, oh, you're a vet, thank you for your service. I think it's patronizing and it bothers me greatly.
That's a good point. But when I was talking about wanting to serve your country, I was looking at it in a more broad sense. I think that if you were at the point now where you couldn't get into the grad school that you wanted to, and you probably wouldn't join the Navy if you knew then what you know now.
No, I certainly wouldn't. And I'm a lot smarter about military and foreign policy and what our government does in the name of democracy and keeping us free and all these platitudes and slogans. So I'm much savvier about that. And the huge difference is that when I joined in 1980, we were not in a hot war. I was never put in a situation where I had to aim a weapon at someone or be in fear for my own safety. So I did not have to make any kind of moral decision. It was relatively easy to go through 20 years of active duty without having to really think about what I was doing in a moral way. So to serve my country, I think I balk at that a little bit. There are many ways to serve your country. And I think upholding the Constitution, I think following democratic principles and speaking out, this is a service to my government and to my country and my fellow citizens, what I'm doing now than what I did on active duty.
Right. So you went in 1980 and you got out, I guess, in 2000, right?
That's right.
Okay. And for the entire 20 years, for that entire two decades, did you have any doubts about the United States as far as similar to the doubts you might have now regarding their military policy, their foreign policy, the way that the military-industrial media banking complex operates in lockstep?
Well, no. And I'm embarrassed about that. When I joined, I startled and really shocked, I think, a lot of my friends and family that I joined the military because I had never thought about it before. And I'd always thought of myself as kind of a liberal. I remember wearing a McGovern button, even though I wasn't old enough to vote at that time.
Right.
So I think everybody was kind of startled when I joined the military. And in fact, I had never given it a thought until I realized that I wasn't going to go to the school I wanted. And I had been working in a grocery store to put my way through college. And one night I was mopping out the check stands and I thought, you know, what's wrong with this picture? I have a degree. I'm still living in this small town that I grew up in. And what are you going to do with your life? My major was in fine art. I didn't really give much thought about how I was going to earn a living. And I will tell you also that my education was not very good. I really had not done any kind of thinking about our foreign policy or understood the history. And I still am really woefully ignorant about all the ways the United States has interfered murdered in other countries. So, no, I was stationed all over the world, but it wasn't until 1991, when the first Gulf War started, that our military was really active in a war. And at that time, I was in Japan. I remember watching it on Japanese television. I was at a remote station, and, you know, I couldn't have been farther away from war at that time. So I didn't give a lot of thought to it. I will say that my own defense, I was a student at the Naval War College, and my papers that I wrote and researched, one paper was on the importance of the United Nations, and another paper was on conflict termination. So you could see I wasn't talking about weapons and tactics and things like that. My interests were the other direction.
Right.
And I do think politically I didn't fit in quite the way most people do. My politics were much more to the left of most people. I can remember getting in lots of discussions with folks about, oh, well, don't ask, don't tell. I thought it was just stupid, and just basic politics and values and things that I was definitely not surrounded by peers in that regard.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just want to step back a second. You said that when you went into the Navy, of course, women couldn't be in any combat positions, and that's changed a whole hell of a lot,
mm-hmm.
hasn't it?
Right.
Now they allow women on even submarines, which I was on a sub, and I don't know. To me, it doesn't make sense, considering the way that guys act on a submarine. Adding a female in there, at least in the enlisted ranks, I don't know. What do you think about that?
It's not something that I'm really very concerned about. I think that gays should have a right to serve. I think women should have a right to serve. But I would dissuade anybody from joining into the military. But I think this is a civil rights matter, not really a matter of war and peace and foreign policy. So I don't think my opinion on this makes a whole lot of difference. It's just not a topic that I'm that concerned with. I think women should be able to do any job that they're physically able to do.
You're focused on this one thing. I like that.
I am.
Yes. That's really great. It's funny because I was in a similar position myself as far as considering myself to be more liberal thinking about various things. And as time went on, I became much more conservative in my views. For 20 years, I don't want to say that you were someone with, one of my colleagues calls it red, white, and blue fever. They're just very patriotic and they believe America is great and America would do no wrong. But you didn't have any reason to doubt the United States like you do now.
Yeah, I guess that's a pretty good way to describe it. I certainly wasn't a big flag waver, and I don't think I would say my country, love it or leave it, or USA is number one. That's nothing that would come out of my mouth. But I was pretty ignorant and not really very curious about what our military was doing. So I was just sort of apathetic and not inquisitive. I wasn't a flag waver, but I also wasn't strongly denouncing or opposing policy either.
You were doing your job, and you served
yeah.
for 20 years.
Yes.
You got your pension, and you got
yes.
out, and
yes.
you could do whatever else you wanted to do, because by the time you got out, you were still very young.
Right, but and I love the irony that I did 20 years on active duty military, and now I can afford to live off my pension and be a full-time peace activist.
Right.
I don't make a ton of money, but I can do that, and it bought me a lot of flexibility and freedom to do the work that is really important to me.
Right. And I always say that the government has a unique ability to create activists out of people. They, you got out in March of 2000, I guess, right? You served 20 years?
July.
Okay. Was 9/11 a significant event for you?
Well, yes, I remember it well, of course. My husband also retired the same day I did. I met him on our final tour, and we had a joint retirement ceremony. And right after we retired, we sold all our belongings, our cars and our furniture, and we bought a sailboat. And we lived on the sailboat for almost 3 years.
Wow.
So on 9/11, we were in Annapolis, Maryland, and our boat was out of the water. And we were at a rental car place to rent a car to drive down to visit my husband's mother in Florida. And at the rental car place, the guy said, hey, something's going on. And we were stunned. And we watched it on television. We kept saying the same thing. Everything's different. But what happened then was that our government had this knee-jerk reaction that somebody's going to have to pay. And Congress, they didn't declare war as the War Powers Act requires and as our Constitution requires, but they did pass something called an Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF. And that was passed just days after 9/11 happened, and it authorized President Bush to attack any person, anywhere, anytime, any country, if he had reason to believe or thought that that person might be involved with 9/11.
Right.
So it was just this open-ended blank check for continuous war on anyone or any country. And this is illegal. It's unconstitutional, and it violates international law, and Barbara Lee was the sole person to vote against that at UMF. And it's really very upsetting to me that there was this huge reaction of, we got to get somebody, somebody's going to pay, and so we attacked Afghanistan. And I'm not sure what the percentage is. I know I've read it somewhere of the percentage of Afghans who have no idea that 9/11 happened and had no understanding of why American troops are in their country. And of course, we know that the Afghan people had nothing to do with 9/11. It was an act of a group of people who happened to be in that country. It's not saying that their government gave them safe haven. It's a preposterous way to fight back against a harm that was caused us. And then, my God, Iraq is just abominable that we attacked a country that had no relation to 9/11 at all. We might as well have attacked Mexico. It had no connection. Thousands and thousands, if not more than a million people have died because of our righteous, we got to make somebody pay, we got to get them before we get us. And in doing so, we've now created a situation where people in other countries are, I think, quite justified in opposing the military actions of our country. We're not making anyone safer, certainly not Afghans or Iraqis, and certainly not Americans. And both of those conflicts that now pushing over into Pakistan, they're completely illegal. They violate the Geneva Conventions and the UN Charters and the Nuremberg Principles. They're illegal on so many fronts. They're immoral on so many fronts. And then when some kind of evidence comes out about actual war crimes, things that are abominable, I'm thinking of the WikiLeaks and the collateral murder video that Bradley Manning is accused of leaking. This young man is now in jail and is charged with an offense that could be punished through the death penalty. He may spend the rest of his life in jail for simply telling the truth of what happens of war. And telling the truth of war should not be a crime. Bradley Manning didn't kill anybody. This government has killed thousands and thousands of people, and we've made refugees of millions of people. And our government is the one that is culpable, not the individual soldiers. And even the soldiers who are shown on the video saying and doing despicable things, they are in a very no-win situation. And I hold the government accountable for that. And they should never be there in the first place. And now we've got these huge problems with post-traumatic stress disorder and brain injuries and the cost of trying to help veterans. And none of this has to be. And the American people have been saying over and over and over again that our priorities are not on weapons spending. Our priorities are health care and education. That's what we want. And our money is not being spent in the areas that we want. And this brings me back around to the problem of we're not being heard. Our values, our will, our preferences are being ignored in favor of the big corporate interest. And war is very profitable. The war machine is very profitable. And the powers that control the government don't want to see an end to war because they're making a lot of money off of it.
Right.
And so we're in this state of perpetual conflict.
And we can't seem to get out of it. Tell the listeners about the organization Veterans for Peace. How long have they been around, and when did you get involved in them?
Well, Veterans for Peace was formed in 1985 by a man named Jerry Genesio, who lived in Maine. He was a Vietnam veteran, and the idea of the organization was to create a bridge between the Vietnam veterans community and the anti-war community. So that was the general gist of it. It started in 1985, like I said, with one chapter in Portland, Maine, and we now have about 150 chapters across the U.S. in almost every state. We have members in every state. We have chapters in Hawaii and Alaska, and we have a chapter in Vietnam, and we are now expanding our connections with veterans. Just recently, a group calling themselves Veterans for Peace UK was launched in London, and we're very excited about joining forces with NATO veterans in opposition to the wars that both of our countries have participated in. We are also recognized by the United Nations as a non-governmental organization, an NGO. So I think that says a lot about us, that we have that kind of recognition as a powerful voice for peace. And we feel that there's lots of peace organizations out there, and there's lots of veterans organizations out there. But we are the sole veterans organization that calls for an end to war, period. And so I think think it's very, very important for us to focus on that portion of our mission and use our voices as veterans, use our stories and our experiences that we have to tell people about the futility of war, the immorality of war, the cost of war, the illegality of war, the ineffectiveness of war, and to tell people firsthand what we know. And we have credibility. We have a voice of authority that a non-veteran peace activist doesn't have.
How many members are in Veterans for Peace?
We have about 5,000 members who are active. We think it should be a lot more than that. I know that there's like 30 million veterans in this country. I think a lot of veterans feel as we do. They just don't know about our organization, and we need to make it easier for them to find us.
How did you get involved with Veterans for Peace?
Well, I had joined it just as a member. I wasn't attached to any chapter. I believe I joined in 2005. And then as I related that experience about the Eyes Wide Open exhibit, after I saw that, that's when I really jumped in, and it was suggested to me that I form a chapter where I live, and I did. We became chapter 132 in January of 2006, and I served as the president of my chapter for 3 years, and then I was elected to the National Board of Directors and served as the vice president of Veterans for Peace for 3 years, and then just the last fall, I was reelected to my second term on the board, and then in January was elected as the president. So I'm very proud to be representing a wonderful organization, and I'm always trying to get the message out about what makes Veterans for Peace unique. What makes us so powerful are our members and our stories, and I just encourage people to check us out and join us. We also do have a portion of our membership who are non-veterans, and they are called associate members, and they are really very important to our work. These are people who don't have that firsthand experience as veterans, but they understand the work that we do, and they support us, and they do a lot of the work themselves. Many of them are either related to or married to somebody who was in the military. So our associate members are also very important to tell our story and help us get our work done.
Is there a fee to join?
We ask for a $40 membership dues nationally, and we also have a reduced rate for people that can't afford that. And even if you can't afford the reduced rate of $25, we want you to participate. If there is a chapter near you, certainly we want to get you involved and hook you up with the local people who will welcome you with open arms, whether or not you have $25 or not. We want to hear your stories, and we want to get that person involved in the work we're doing. And if there is no chapter near someone, then we can get that person involved in working groups. We have groups that are organized by issue instead of by geography. So, for instance, we have working groups on many, many topics. One of them is resistance, GI resistance. So we work very closely with resistance groups, Courage to Resist, the Military Task Force from the National Lawyers Guild, the Bradley Manning Support Network. The working groups are organized around these issues. It's a way for people to get more deeply involved with the specific issues that are of concern to them rather than the broad mission of bringing an end to war. So I invite people to check out the website. It's veteransforpeace.org, all one word, veteransforpeace.org. And we also have a Facebook page, and we do Twitter and all that. Check it out. And even if you're not a veteran, we'd love to have you find out what we do and see if this is something you'd like to support.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website. It's great. It says the U.S. military spends over $20 billion per year in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then there's a hyphen. It says on air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
That's right. We're part of something called the New Priorities Network, which is a group of organizations that seek to reprioritize our federal budget and take money away from the military spending and put it into the programs that the American people want and need, like education and health care. So the $20 billion, you think about what we could have spent that money on that would help people. It costs $1 million for one soldier for a year tour in Afghanistan, $1 million. And I live in a nice, fairly prosperous town in Oregon, and we recently had to cut library hours, and there was a big threat that the senior center was going to have to be shut down. The public swimming pool was going to have to be closed unless we passed a tax levy to make up for the $1.3 million budget problem that we had. And this is just my town. There are communities all over our country that are laying off teachers, laying off firefighters, closing services that the public needs and wants and uses, because we are spending so much money on the war machine. And we have been saying this for years and years and years, what we want our money spent on, and Congress is ignoring us.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about in this one topic you just brought up, but getting back to 9/11 and Veterans for Peace, does Veterans for Peace pay attention to perhaps the underlying causes of why the United States is involved in so many illegal wars, or are they just interested in stopping it? They're not interested in, geez, how did we get to this point?
Oh, no, I think we're very interested in how do we get to this point and preventing wars before they happen and stopping them once they have started. So we have working groups on different geographic areas, Iran and Palestine and different issues like that. It's hard to know exactly what different chapters are doing and different individuals are doing, but we have a great number of people who are published authors who write and speak and talk about their experiences. Brian Wilson, Wilson with two L's, is somebody I'm thinking of that has done a great deal of research and writing on our foreign policy and the military and is just a phenomenal mind in thinking about that kind of thing. Ray McGovern is also a member of Veterans for Peace, and he is brilliant. Daniel Ellsberg is a member of Veterans for Peace. The late Howard Zinn was a member of Veterans for Peace. So we have a lot of thinkers. We have a lot of people who really understand what it's all about, and we probably could find better ways to, and I think this is something our organization needs to work on, is how to amplify those voices and find vehicles for them to be heard, and whether that's interviews or videos or publishing, writing or speaking tours. I see all the time on television, I see the same two or three people every time there's an issue about military.
Yeah.
I see Paul Rykoff and this retired Colonel Jack Jacoby, I think is his last name. Paul Rykoff, he talks about veterans benefits. He talks about supporting the troops and finding them jobs. He works for an organization called Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. They're very successful. They're very powerful, but they're not anti-war. So I don't see any veterans' voice in the major media talking about what we talk about. In fact, a lot of the people you see talking about as experts or pundits about war and peace and foreign policy are retired military folks who are on the payroll of these contractors and defense contractors. Barry McCaffrey is a great example. He's on the board of DynCorp. He's always talking about military interventionism as if, well, of course, this is what we need to do. He makes money every time he says something like that. And then, of course, you know quite well about Cheney and Halliburton and these other contractors. But anyway, the point is that when major media want to talk to veterans, they pick the same couple people, and they're not talking to the anti-war veterans. And in fact, Veterans for Peace is the only organization that has this point of view. I'm trying to find ways for our voice to be heard by more people who maybe don't follow independent journalism. So we have to expand our sphere of influence. Military term, sorry about that. 20 years.
Right. It's corrupted you. It's part of that ball of yarn you were talking about.
Right.
So it's probably not going to be possible for Veterans for Peace to break into the mainstream media, which is controlled just by a few prominent families, mm-hmm. which is involved in the many interlocking directorates of boards of directors. Because when Barry McCaffrey is on the board of DynCorp and he's also on the board of Fox News or whatever mm-hmm. it might be, there's too many interests that would be damaged if Veterans for Peace was given a voice. So it's probably not going to happen.
No, I think you're right. Last August, Paul Rykoff and some fellow members of IAVA were on the cover of Time magazine, and Joe Klein had written this article called The New Greatest Generation, and I wrote an essay that was published in Common Dreams in a couple places about why you won't see Veterans for Peace on the cover of Time. And Time is part of the big media machine, that it's in their interest to keep the war machine going, and it's a big part of the problem. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
It is discouraging to see how many people are only concerned about themselves and their own entertainment. But what you said made me think of something. It is very hard to capture people's attention and get them to think outside their own little sphere. I was talking with somebody on the radio the other day, and they were saying, well, you know, some people live in a world where their reality is their family and their friends, and that's their bubble. And others live in a reality with their family and their friends and their community and their region, or maybe their country. And then others think of themselves as their bubble is the whole world, and they think of others as equals, and then how what they do impacts everyone. And so our society, American society, does not promote this thinking outside your own bubble. We think of ourselves as extraordinary, and that our government, this theory of exceptionalism, that it can't be wrong if we do it, and that Earth's resources are there for Americans to use, and that we will fight and kill and die for the American way of life, not for Americans necessarily, but for our way of life. And this is going to take a long time. It really takes instilling different set of values in people as their children and making them more cognizant of the world around them and their interconnection with others and other communities. And I've said many times, if American children were killed in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we wouldn't allow them to continue. Well, if we could get all the bad guys and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and Saddam Hussein and all the people we think are bad people and should be done away with, but 50 American children had to die in the process, the American people wouldn't put up with that. We'd be outraged. But it doesn't bother us that thousands of Iraqi and Afghan and Pakistani children have been killed with our weapons because of our policies. And why is that? Why aren't we outraged by that? We're oblivious. So one of my theories is that there are really four basic reasons to oppose war. And the first one is that it's immoral. It kills innocent people. And that should be compelling reason enough for people to oppose war, but it isn't. The second reason is that it's illegal. It violates all kinds of, like I mentioned, treaties and international law and things that we should be upholding as part of a global community. Thirdly, it's ineffective. You can't impose democracy at the point of a gun. That's an oxymoron. And you can't create peace by killing people. It's an absurd concept. So it doesn't accomplish what it sets out to do or what it says it sets out to do. But lastly is it's too expensive. It's too costly economically. And this is now the reason that is starting to resonate with the American people, is that people are starting to see we're laying off teachers or we're laying off firefighters, and why is that they're starting to see the connection, I think, that our government's priorities on spending on the war machine are affecting them economically. So now we're starting to infringe on that little bubble of a person's immediate needs and, well, why isn't the library open 7 days a week like it used to be? And they're starting to see that there is a connection. And so I'm hopeful that Occupy has now touched this nerve where people are outraged and they may not see the connection yet between the war machine and the disparity between the 1% and the 99%. They may not quite see that yet, but I think it's our job as anti-war activists to help make that connection and to help synergize this outrage and energy that's coming from Occupy and help them understand why the war machine has to be stopped. And this has to be a big part of what Occupy is doing. It's not enough just to say people are making too much money or they're not paying enough taxes or whatever, but it does boil down to those two things. How do we end the deficit in the wars and tax the rich, which is what I told the Super Committee. And this is what the American people are saying. We just have to keep saying it, and we have to have the courage of those convictions to maybe risk something, our liberty or our personal freedom. We may have to go to jail. We may have to pay penalties that we don't want to pay, but for the greater good. And so that kind of brings us around to why we're talking.
Exactly. That was perfect.